So welcome everyone to the August session of the Intel Hub. I'd like you all to meet Eric Kleinsmith, our presenter today. Eric is the Associate Vice President for Strategic Relations in Intelligence, National Homeland, and Cybersecurity for American Military University. He has extensive experience in intelligence and security-related training and analysis, along with expertise in counterintelligence, information operations, asymmetric threats, and tactical military operations. Spending over a decade as an armor military intelligence officer in the U.S. Army, Eric has been at the front of the intelligence community in both the conduct of intelligence operations as well as the future development of intelligence operations and analysis. Culminating his military career as a chief of intelligence for the U.S. Army's land information warfare activity, Eric pioneered the development of asymmetric threat analysis using the cutting-edge data mining technology of the Intelligence and Security Command's Information Dominance Center. In this capacity, Eric gained U.S. notoriety related to his involvement in the Able Danger program as the military lead of a team of analysts profiling and mapping Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. Eric is an accomplished author, and his latest book, Intelligence Operations, Data, Tools, People, and Processes, will be released in January 2020. Eric is also part of a private investigative group who have identified the identity of the notorious D.B. Cooper, one of the only unsolved terrorism cases in U.S. history. He's also testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and the U.S. Armed Services Committee, and has appeared on several news shows. So without further ado, Eric, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, and I do believe that you have access to move your slides forward. If for whatever reason, just let me know, and I can do that for you as well.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. And just two things on what you just read is, one, is the guy that we had identified as D.B. Cooper passed away, I think, 3 weeks ago in San Diego. And then the other thing is the book that I have is actually coming out in December now instead of January. So, and this presentation is really based as a summary of that entire book that's coming out. Yep, it does work. So I'm advancing it forward. First thing I start to do is really just to get folks into the mindset of taking a look at these different components of intel operations. One is to really look at it from a dysfunctional standpoint and take a look at what's broken within your organization. So it's just what I normally do when I do this in person is I ask folks to just write down things that are broke or dysfunctional, or you know, dire need of improvement within their organization. We don't need to share the list, you know, in the group, but just by doing that, it just gives you an idea of, you know, you might have something problem with your boss. You might have a problem with the way communications work, that nobody talks to each other, or that there's a lot of disparate cells that don't cooperate, do redundant work, step on each other's toes, or it's just the fact that our data feeds stink. Or our tools are horrible, and you know, you see everybody in different organizations say, hey, they got great tools. You go to where I work, it's like, oh, our automation's horrible. It could be across the board where things are just broken that keep you from doing the job that you think that's probably the best thing. What you find is, and this is where these are the four pillars I'm talking about, is each one of those problems is going to fit that you identify into one of these four areas. You're either going to have, in order to have an intel operation, you have to have data coming in from whatever the source, whether it's a stream, a database, message traffic, or just the ability to go out and do searches open source or in a classified environment. But then once you have that in your center or your operation, you also have to have tools that help you access that, and whether it's tools that will bring it in, parse it, catalog it, meta tag it, or it's visualization tools on the back end that allow the analyst to actually see the data, not one message at a time, but to be able to draw links and inferences and to be able to you know, physically map out the data that you're pulling in, especially if it's a massive amount and you're getting into the big data or the data mining piece. But that's just the first two things. And what we really tend to forget about are that, and I've seen this especially after 9/11, where lots of members of the intelligence community said, well, we're going to create our own intel center. We'll just take a a location, we're going to put a bunch of data and tools in there, and then voila, we have it. And what they forget is that it really takes people and process. And so the broken part, many of the broken pieces that when somebody identifies something that's dysfunctional, it's not on the technical side, it's actually on it, with the people, bringing in the wrong people, or with the processes that really folks don't have one. And I don't know how many centers I've gone into or talked to where this, what's your standard operating procedure on how you'd work from day to day? It's like, what are you talking about? We don't do that. And I've even had one center, and I won't bring out who they were, but I got the answer was, well, we're unique, we're special, because our mission is different. We're unique of everybody else, so we really don't have concrete processes like everybody. And my answer to them was like, well, do you collect? Do you process? Do you analyze and produce a product? Then you're doing the same thing that everybody else does. You are no different. You and your analysts do deserve to have a standard operating procedure or something that works within that. Underneath all of this is that every organization, every intelligent organization, has these pillars, but they also must exist either in a physical or a virtual or hybrid environment. And that's a whole other topic to get into, but those two pieces are the foundation. And all of this, again, is to support the customer, and that's why the customer is at the top. So when we get into some of the data pieces, there's several ways to evaluate data. And I can, you know, imagine that if you wrote down and you thought, well, God, our data is horrible. It's the first question, and especially on the first two, is who decided what data was coming in? And was an analyst involved in the process? Or was it left up to the engineers to say, all right, here's the data that we're going to bring into you. Why? Because it's what we can get easily without having to go through too many hurdles. Well, some of that data works, some of it doesn't. And so there's different ways to evaluate. And I spend an entire chapter in the book coming out on taking a look at data feeds in particular. And so these are really the six ways that I've listed there, from information security to the reliability of the data. And then what I'm drawing out here is just the functionality. And it's just several series of questions that break down. You can have it, you can evaluate data from a technical standpoint or to look at it from a bias or, you know, how well it works, you know, from computer to computer or data or storage system, you know, from technical aspect. But the functionality is, does this data actually help me? Do I actually have a means to, this is, you know, great source of database, but I have no way of visualizing it. Or it's just so much data that's in there. There's so much garbage that I got to go through with it. I don't have a tool that will help me sift through that automatically. So therefore, this data set's almost a waste of time unless I can do some sort of workaround or sneaker gap or some other way of getting the data into the products that I need to use. A way to look at, break it down a little bit differently, this is a build slide. So let's see how this works. Okay, one is just take a look at who owns it. Who contributes to it, who made it, who was it made for? And then second is, how do I get it? How do I get it physically into my center? Is there a data pipe that's already been built, or do we have a problem? Is there a bandwidth issue because I'm working in a remote location? And then again, how do I get it into my tools? How do I get it into my database? And then finally, once you can do all that, is what kind of data is it? Do I have permissions? Are there classification issues? So all of these are just some standard questions. And there's, you know, an exhaustive list that we can go into on taking a look at the data that you have. And I'll tell you, and anybody that's working in an Intel center, there's 90% of the data is worthless to them. You know, it's just, you know, whether because it's sitting in the wrong format, because it's not in, you know, in a usable condition, because it's the wrong classification or whatever, and they can't bring it down to a product that they have to export. So that's just one way of taking a look at the data sets alone and give you an idea of things to evaluate from that pillar. The other thing is take a look at it by discipline. And depending on the type of source, and that's on the left-hand side, that's going to give you some analytical detail. So when you're looking at a particular problem set, and all you need to have is situational awareness, open source is your way to go. It's readily available. It's easy to get a hold of. It's, you know, the entire internet boom from the 90s set up this source to make it the most preeminent need for Intel. 90% of what you're going to work in any problem set is going to come from open source. But once you get into more detailed problem sets, we really have to get into scoping out a problem, profiling, or near real-time targeting. Open source dwindles in its efficiency, and it gets more and more worthless. You can't, especially if we're running a tactical operation, you cannot target a drug dealer. You cannot find, the specific location somebody is in by going and using open source, especially for hard targeting from a military standpoint. At the opposite end of the that's laid out, SIGINT is just the opposite. It's horrible for situation awareness, but it does give you some of that real near-time data set, depending on if you're working on a government classified system or not. And then imagery across the board is helpful. The thing to distinguish imagery from other data sets is that on the situation awareness and discovery analysis, imagery is usually going to be open source. But once you get into some of the more classified systems, air breathing platforms, satellite systems, that's going to be over on your right-hand side. And then finally, HUMINT is really designed for the mid-level detail. So it's not really good for situation awareness, not good for targeting. Because it takes so long to set up a HUMINT network in a particular area, and just the reporting structure takes time to go from a casual source or a low-level source to be able to use that for any kind of tackle operations, becomes problematic and very labor-intensive on the collector's part. So again, that's just taking a look at data. Now we take a look at some of the tools, and there's ways to evaluate the tools for the next pillar. This is where you're asking questions like, what does this tool actually do? And I can tell you, I used to run the Army's Foundry training program since 2000. It was a training program in 2002 that became Foundry in 2006. And within that time, we must have instructed 200 different tools that the Army had bought into, and had seen, twice as many that were folks that were trying to sell the Army tools or sell us tools in particular for the defense contractor I worked for. And every one of them was going to tell you this tool does everything and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's once you get into some of these more targeted questions, what does this tool actually do? And then more importantly, what does it not do? What are the workarounds that I have to use to be able to put this tool in place? And then where does it fit within the analytical cycle? Where does it actually help me in my operations? I might have lots of collection tools, but then nothing to do analysis with. And then what are the mechanisms for getting data into it, and then also getting in intel or visualization or even a direct product out of the tool? And then finally, what analytical processes can I now do with this? And that takes time, and it requires your analyst to get on this tool and work on it till you can break it, or work on it till you can actually discover something new that you can do with it. This has been a big problem across the board, and it's one of the reasons why there's been this decade-long fight that's going on within the military between the Distributed Common Ground System, which is called DSIGS. Did I say that? It's the Army and their acronyms are killing me. And then another tool out of California called Palantir, where Palantir had their own congressman, had their own lobby group saying that this is our solution for DSIGs. You don't need to spend all that money on DSIGs. You need to spend the money on our tool. Well, it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. And once you get into the technical aspects, you find that Palantir doesn't do all the things that DSIGs was intended to do. It only does one or two of those things. And so that's, the entire fight became, it was newsworthy. It became a little ridiculous on how far it went to the extent. And a lot of times it was fostered by folks who did not know how to ask these questions about their tools. There's one tool in particular. This is a DoD tool developed by, I think it was the National Security Agency, but it was the one called Renoir. And they did this tool, and they thought it was fantastic, and they ran it over unscripted text that was coming off of, actually they used Saturday morning cartoons, I think, on the Cartoon Network years and years ago. And they found that if they used a proximity algorithm and that somebody talked to somebody else within the script of the closed caption text, it would draw a link between the two. And so you'll see on the On the left-hand side, you'll see some of the different shows when they're playing, the old-time shows. They were playing the Lucy Show, the Jetsons, the Flintstones, the Bonanza, things like that. And what they didn't understand was, like, why is this center node linked to everyone? It's a character called Astro. And what the tool did not pick up was that Astro was not only the dog for the Jetsons, but it was also Astro Boy, which was a sci-fi cartoon character that was introducing each of the shows in turn. And the closed caption text did not distinguish between those two people. And that's, again, shows the limitation even on some of the most basic tools that use different algorithms, that they, you know, that the folks who made it might think that this is a fantastic thing, and but the tool itself is not that great. Again, this is a tool called Renoir or Parentage, which has not then been superseded by another tool called Renoir. And quite honestly, desigs kind of overtook all of these, and so there's very few that come out. Link analysis tools are some of the most problematic ones that are out there. One of the things to take a look at this, and this was the tools that the Army INSCOM used years and years ago, is that there were so many tools, and the analysts were coming in, and they were overwhelmed by them, that we never really gave them a fair shake. And, you know, we've had to start an entire training program to train up individual tools, but it still wasn't answering the questions as where do all these tools fit within the processes I want to use. And so we took this analytical process down at the bottom that INSCOM, that we were using for training and that INSCOM had incorporated, and we started plugging these tools in for where they work. So if anybody knows anything about Analyst Notebook, it is a great tool that allows you to do some really preliminary analysis. You manually create your link analysis diagrams. You can do some detail analysis, and a lot of times some analysts can brief right off of that, the link charts that they build, and that can be their presentation. So it allows them to build a product at the same time for Analyst Notebook. Problem is Analyst Notebook is not made to collect anything. It doesn't help you with identifying requirements. It doesn't do any kind of information management in that way. It is simply a way to draw a link analysis diagram with some bells and whistles with, like, different versions of it. And so that it's great for certain parts of the analytical process, but it's not great for the front end. On the other hand, when you run into tools at the front end, the big disconnect is some of these tools don't connect to, you know, there's no way to feed them in. And so Analyst Notebook for years has always been a manual process that had to be fat-fingered in by the analysts as they were going through other tools and then having to manually build them. That became problematic. And now you're seeing a lot of the different tool developers are trying to do things that they can do automatic ingestions, and some of them are hit and miss either way. Another example I'll give you, this one is I did some consulting with the Criminal Investigative Task Force. This is a group located on Fort Belvoir, and their specific aim is to build prosecution cases against the detainees from the War on Terror, whether they're in Gitmo or other locations, primarily down in Gitmo. And they were having a huge morale problem with the intelligence analysts that were working in that center. And after interviewing a lot of the folks that were there and looking at their tools, I'd use the same method, and I drew this chart. And came back and showed them among the other findings. And as I was briefing through this, the analysts became more and more agitated. And finally, one of them just couldn't take it and just blurted it out. He said, "This is our problem right here. We have a ton of tools that do collection, but we as the analysts are not empowered to do any kind of analysis. The lawyers have to do it. So the only thing we're doing is working as almost pseudo paralegals. We just give them information. And when the lawyers come down," they actually called it lawyer day. When the lawyers came down to build their cases, this is what the analysts would give them what they found. The lawyers would do all their analysis and then come back and say, "We needed to collect on this, this, and this, and this." That wasn't doing analysis there. And that's how they discovered that their analysts hated working there, and their turnover rate was near 80% annually. So that just by showing them this chart, it showed them a problem with their process that was not fused with the tools that they had brought in. And they needed to change their process and empower their analysts and let them make more decisions on where the analysis needed to go and where the collection needed to be changed to. Again, that took some time, and it took some pain and suffering in order to reveal this and bring that forward. Then the pillar we take a look at for third is the people. And again, this is one that's often overlooked. And a lot of intel centers really don't have a clear understanding of where exactly are their people coming from. I mean, you have government folks in some cases, or you have defense contractors or defense contracted employees, or you're working on the civil side and it's somebody who's from, you know, your police department, or they're from your company that's working within your corporate security. Your intel analysts are going to come from four primary sources. Either they're going to come from the military, which means they have prior training in certain aspects of it, or they're going to come from law enforcement, and somebody who's been quote unquote reflagged, whether they're already a criminal investigator, and they come in the next day, saying, you know, all of a sudden now you are an intel analyst, and the investigator's like, I have no idea what that means, different from what I'm doing. Other than criminal investigators spend their time finding out has happened in the past, while intel analysts are supposed to be doing predictive analysis on what they think is going to happen towards the future. And again, because we're from, you know, we are from AMU, we'd like to emphasize the fact that there is a new wave of intel analysts that are coming in. They're coming straight out of college. One of the pieces of advice I used to give to folks that wanted to go into intel was do something else first, because the intel community is like an accessions community. They bring people in from other walks of life who have experience in other areas, law enforcement, military, or even computer techs. Folks that developed the same data mining tools can then use them for analysis. But college students is a new feeder to bring in fresh blood with a different mindset, even a wholly different generation. I think we're now having Generation Z that is getting ready to graduate, and they're entering the workforce. And so these are your next generations of analysts who are much more savvy than any of us are in understanding data, understanding automation and computers, and being able to work with massive amounts of data. So again, there's different ways of doing that. But then again, each center has to ask the next question: with these different sources of people that I have coming in, what do I have that brings them up to speed? What's my expectation on how they should be performing, and how am I actually assisting that within my own organization internally? I just can't send them off to a school and say, come back and do great things. They have to learn the specific data, tools, people, and processes of that job. So is it on-the-job training? Are you building an internal professional development program? All of those are different programs that need to be put in place for your people. The other thing that's just taken a look at from your personnel standpoint is personnel manning. And I included this in the book just as a way of doing a small measure of planning out the number of people and what roles they should be in, depending on the size of the intel organization. So if you're working in a small group, the intel chief is 3 to 4 people. You're going to have a leader, and you're going to be doing and a small team, and everybody's pretty much going to be the same, and you're going to be divvying out duties and responsibilities that are generally across the board. Everybody's going to be doing everybody else's job. There's just no other people to do that. It's only until you get into a large organization that you can start to subdivide into product development, collection managers, the human support, the team, actually having different teams focused on different areas, whether it's geographic areas or different analytical mission sets. Then you can break out with a team leader and the teams of personnel. But again, it has to be a graduated way based upon your mission set. But, you know, again, this gives you a quick roadmap on taking a look at that from a personnel standpoint. And then the last thing we do is take a look at the intel in terms of the processes. And everybody knows that this is the intel operations process. It's still the basic one as written in military doctrine. Problem is, this is what happens to it when you let an engineer get a hold of it. And not to disparage engineers, but this was created in order to tell the analyst, this is how you're supposed to do your business. Well, in actuality, nobody's going to read this, nobody's going to take a look at it, and certainly nobody's going to follow it. And so, again, this is a process that is dictated by technology instead of dictated by the actual analysts, the people that need to do the work. When you look at the analytical process, the intel cycle actually works differently in reality. And really, you're building an intel process that's based upon the customer as the most important part, and you're linking that back to the analysts themselves. And it's more of a communication. So the customer generates requirements. In the middle of all this, collection operations are going on concurrently, and the analyst is able to tap into that, but then they start their analytical process, and they go through identifying the requirements, collecting, doing preliminary analysis, detail analysis, and then not part of the analytical process is building the product, completing and disseminating, and then coordinating back with the customer. This seems like a fairly simple process, but again, there has to be a way to get out of the cycle early. So if somebody identifies a requirement, you already had the answer, why go through the whole process? Jump out of it early, build your product, and send it back to them. Or if it may be something simple as somebody else had developed the product, all you need to do is collect it, put your own label on it and some comments, and then send it back to the customers. You do not have to do the entire analytical process. And, oh, by the way, you have to be able to go back and collect information at different points. That's simply the analytical, the Intel operations with the analytical process embedded into it, how it's actually practiced in reality, not based upon doctrine or something else. All these things have to be looked at from a process standpoint within your own operation. There's also different ways of taking a look at intelligence responses. What different products do I need to have? You could have products, or you may be responsible for doing some sort of presentation. And it could be a simple briefing. It could be formal, informal. If you're working in a military tactical environment, you're going to be doing very little in terms of formal written products, very little in terms of graphics and things like that. Your work is going to be informal briefings and presentations, wargaming and doing the execution side, just because of the fast pace of that environment. And once you move into the strategic environment, you're going to start moving over to the left of the chart, and you're going to start doing reports and periodicals and references and graphics and things that take time and actually require a production and even a production assistance in order for you to get that done. And so, again, we took a look at each of these four pillars, data, tools, people, and processes. The key to remember on all this is that every successful operation has to have all four of these have to be in working order. If there is one thing that is broke in one of these pillars or makes that entire pillar dysfunctional, your entire operation is broke. So you may have the great data coming in. You may have fantastic tools. You may have great processes that somebody wrote down and says, this is how we're going to do this. But if you don't have the people with the skill set to handle it, it's never going to work. And just, again, you can imagine any other scenario where you have three of the four and one of them doesn't work. Again, your operation is dysfunctional and not providing that support to the customer that they need. That's really the key takeaway. So if you need to evaluate your own operation, or you need to build your task of building a new one from scratch, and there's still new organizations that are popping up on the commercial side, on the law enforcement, or on the national side. These are the things that you must take a detailed look at, and if you're doing it with a team of people, assign one person to each of these pillars. You are responsible to make sure that we have the right data coming in at the right times, and that is linked into the right tools, and we have the permissions to work that. Again, that's a way to take a look at it and to break down your operation into four manageable areas. Last thing, just as a plug, please check out our blog sites. One of the last articles I have coming out is based on D-Day and would D-Day have happened if it was in the world of social media. Would we be able to pull off the deception plans of Fortitude and Bodyguard? Take a look at those. And then, again, if you have any questions, here's my phone number, my email. If you want to follow through on anything, feel free to send me an email, contact me, or whatever. I'd be happy to answer your questions, even if you don't think of it today. So with that, anybody have anything they want to send out?
Thanks for that presentation, Eric. I think that it's really, really informative. The one question that comes to mind for me is given the dynamics at work here and how college students become a kind of a pipeline for future analysts, and then also knowing the dynamic of people coming in with backgrounds outside of Intel, when it comes to best preparing students that want to go into, say, an Intel analyst field, what advice would you provide to higher educators in higher ed and how they might best incorporate, you know, different concepts into the classes, and so that way the students coming out of college do have an edge when it goes to applying for some of these jobs that are available in this market.
Right. I would say it's what, you know, when you're going through a straight Intel education program, that's going to give a student the flexibility to really go anywhere as an entry-level analytical position. If the key to making that is apply that to a secondary topic. And so if you're going into military intel, I was reading, you know, obviously military history books until, you know, late at night, just because I knew that was the area if I was going into. If I was going into intel analysis from a financial side, I would need to know separately, you know, I would start taking financial classes as my electives, you know, or something like that. The FinCEN, which is the Financial Analytical Center for the Intel community, that's, you know, being versed in that secondary topic is what's going to allow you to take the skills from the Intel program and then more efficiently apply them toward your job in particular. Almost like, yes, learn the basics, fill your toolkit, but then learn the environment you're going to be going into so you know where to apply those tools.
Perfect. It looks like we've got some comments in the chat, too, from Casey Skavork, one of our faculty members with AMU, that as a lawyer and a psychologist, the slides effectively illustrate in a user-friendly way how optimal collection and analysis processes work. And then from Al right. Lewis, pillars seem to be from the Intel team perspective. The bricks they might be built on could include executive support, funding, and authority to operate. What do you think about that, Eric?
Right. No, I agree. And that's the, you know, the piece. Yeah, it is specifically, I'm going to go back to it. You know, it is specifically designed from an Intel team's perspective. And that's, you know, as I put this together, actually this, you know, this process down the bottom, that, let me go to the previous one. Actually, I updated it. But you're right. That's all part of that foundational piece called the Intel organization. And that gets skipped over a lot. And it's more than just a collection of analysts. You know, one of the most critical people within our Intel organization was, quite frankly, well, two, was the lawyer and the guy who ran the budget. So we're looking at the basics piece here. And the guy who ran the budget was the guy who understood where, you know, what resources we had available. If we needed to bring in another tool, this was the guy that we, you know, wanted to make sure we could afford it given what we had. And this was a military center. You know, every center is going to have that. But our legal person became more and more involved as we started getting into more and more cutting edge. As the first data mining operation in DOD history, we were running into all kinds of problems to the point that we were shut down by DOD while we were tracking Al-Qaeda, and that became the whole scandal surrounding the Able Danger mission. So he's absolutely right. That one, it looks like a thin layer within the diagram that says Intel organization, but it includes, you know, so many other people, the technicians, the your public affairs, all these folks that have to be involved with that in order to help it operate.
Yeah, and then Beth has got a comment and question in the chat, too. I'm curious about your comments on the difference in specifically SIGINT and OSINT. Is that specifically related to Army intelligence analysis? I would estimate that the ratio is completely the opposite in Air Force intelligence, for example. SIGINT is 90% the collection method of choice for SA, and OSINT provides little value. I think this would be true for collection on many of the more technical military capabilities. And I would also add on to that in thinking more holistically about intelligence in general. I mean, this, you know, Beth, your comments seem to be specific towards more government-based, but what would it look like also when you open it up to competitive intelligence in business or private intelligence in general as well?
Right. And that's the thing. It's like, if, like I said with OSINT, if all you really need to know is, you know, the questions that come is like, what the heck's going on in this country? You can find that in open source, but you know, especially in military, especially if, and there's a difference between Army and the Marine Corps versus Navy and Air Force, where the Navy and Air Force intel is much more directed toward hard targeting or targeting of hard targets, putting lethal weapons or onto somebody who's a bad person. They're almost solely going to exist in the right side of this diagram, whereas Army and Marine Corps folks doing land operations are going to delve more into, you know, tapping into human sources, tapping into open source and things like that. It really depends on where your mission set is and what side of the analytical detail you're on that's going to work that. For folks who are working in, let's say, NSA, their SIGINT is their life. That's what it is, but they still have to rely upon some of these other sources to give them that situational awareness. And a lot of times that's given to them by analysts. For NSA to do anything, they have to operate off of what's called a SIGINT amplification or SIGINT. And that's somebody that sends something in and says, we need you to take a look at this particular area or these particular IP addresses or whatever. That's giving that the request itself is giving them the situational awareness for them to go in and start targeting specific locations in the cyber realm or in the electromagnetic sphere. So yeah, she's absolutely right. It depends on where you sit within your mission set and how much situational awareness you actually need. If 90% of your work is SIGINT, then you're going to find yourself on the right-hand side where you're doing much more detailed targeting of individuals or mission sets. I don't want to get into some of the classification stuff, but that's really a way to lay it out.
No, I think that's really some really good perspective. Is there any other questions or comments for Eric in the chat? I know I want to be respectful of your time, and I know Eric's got a lot of great insight into this area, so I see Charles is typing. So Eric, while these other questions might be coming in, what do you see as kind of the hardest thing for an organization to really overcome when you go and you talk to them about some of these different challenges? Where are the key sticking points?
The people. I guess it's really a disconnect between, the biggest thing I found is a disconnect between the people and in terms of the mindset that are coming in. And I'll give you an example is, when they built the center that we worked in, the engineers came up with the tools, the engineers came up with the data set, and then they threw all us analysts in there, and it took us 6 months to figure it out. I mean, we were really dead in the water trying to work this. And I was the first Intel chief of this organization. So it just took us a while until we found the right people that could make the tools sing. But it was always a struggle, and it was always a conflict between what we asked for capabilities and what the engineers are feeding us. And finally an engineer said, you know, we're reaching a point where the last Intel analyst has already been born. In a generation, we're not going to need you guys. And that was the mentality that we had. It's not even worth answering because it's such a ridiculous comment, but that's what we had to fight through. And so it seems to be fairly easy to put data and tools into a place and call it a center. It becomes much more difficult to incorporate people and processes. And a lot of times the folks who are the managers are not geared toward doing that. That's just not within their skill set.
Well, that makes sense. I see Casey Skavork is typing in the chat. And Charles didn't have any other questions. So, Eric, when it comes to kind of moving some of these different concepts forward, where is there room for additional research in this area that you see? What are some of these different things that you think need to happen moving forward when it comes to these different elements of operations?
Yeah. I approach everything from, I was a humanities major. I mean, it was for my bachelor's, and so it was, I approach everything from a human, social, political science perspective. I have to constantly train myself on some of the data and the tools and the technology and relearn that every almost every 18 months. I have to spend time doing that on my own time. And it just gets away from me. There's just not a lot out there. Or taking a look at how social media has changed the environment or how social media as a intel source has to be handled. So I have to do it from that perspective, as I know I have weaknesses from my background in data and tools. but I do know people and processes enough to be able to work from that perspective. I would say then on the other side is if you have people working in your organization that are data and tools savvy, you have to identify those folks and then train them back into on aspects of the people and processes side and take a look at, look, we're going to need to redo this process. It just does not work with the changes you made to that tool or something like that. I hope that answers your question, right?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it looks like Casey's question is, what methods do you use to reduce Intel staff resistance to utilize your analytic methods? That's a great question.
Part of it is it's hard to make an Intel a process, like say, and just come up with scratch and say, all right, everybody's going to do this. What I ended up, and that's why when I redid the Intel, when I did this process, it wasn't that I made it up. All I did was simply articulate how it's actually working. And so it wasn't that I'm forcing somebody into a square peg into a round hole, says you're all going to do this. That's what happened to me in the military a lot, where it was, hey, we came up with this great system. I think it was called Warrior, and it was a prelord to a warlord, then they came ASAS and all these different generations. And as a battalion, infantry battalion intel officer and then an armor brigade intel officer, we just didn't even bring him to the field. And it was worthless to us. So that's what I mean. It was just until we had somebody come down and do an effective training program, you're not going to use the tools. And this was the biggest problem when the military started fielding the DSIGs as a tool. The engineers would come out to whatever remote location. We called them drive-by fieldings because they throw the tools in there. Said, "All right, go to work," and they gave them like a half hour worth of training, and it was worthless. So we had to send our own teams out 2 weeks later, and spend weeks with these folks, sometimes in Iraq or in Kuwait or wherever, what remote locations, sometimes by helicopter. And we spent 2 weeks with these folks to get them trained up, and only then after that were they trained to use a new method or trained to use a new tool. It's just, you just cannot throw something in there and say, all right, go to work. They're just going to go back to their own, the way that they understand and what's comfortable with them.
And then another question from Al, Eric, is one issue that I'm concerned with when working in the private sector is demonstrating the return on investment for intelligence. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Let's see. I've done some consulting for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We did... and I've done training for, Disney, Target, Yum Foods, I mean, all kinds of different organizations that are strictly out of the private sector. And honestly, it's for Al, I hate to say this, but you're going to run into two different types of people. We used to call them the get-its and the don't-get-its. And you're going to have to find somebody who gets it and who understands the importance of doing intelligence analysis. And again, you're not doing it for the sake. They don't like to call it intelligence analysis. They like to call it corporate security. I mean, there is a professional organization, the Society for Competitive Intelligence Professionals, or SCIP, that's out there that you can turn to help tap into a lot of their resources. In fact, they got some great sources on. I think there's actually a book they published on building a competitive intelligence function that is actually very helpful. And that can, again, you have to sell this as a capability. And show and demonstrate the importance. And again, this is the Yum Foods. They own Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, KFC, Roy Rogers. They're the parent company, the largest restaurant company, I think, in the world. And yet they have an Intel function because they have to protect their secret sauce. They have to take a look at the hazardous areas for having their 120,000 employees go into a certain country that may not be a favorable country, and they have to do executive protection of their leadership, their CEO, things like that. So there is a ton of different, whether it's anecdotal, but a ton of different ways that you can sell folks on there. And then there's some resources like SCIP that's available that can help you articulate that. But again, you have to sell that to the customer. It's one of the things that we used to say, and we hate to say, I hate to say this now, but from our small elitist attitude, we had a saying that said, we're helping the customer in spite of themselves. But again, they are the most important piece. And if you cannot sell them on your piece, then it's never going to work.
And I think also part of that, Eric, might be knowing what language to use depending on which audience you're working with. So, for example, in threat management field, they do intelligence analysis, but for the most part, they prefer to say threat management. It's a little bit more tangible for when you're working in resources or something like that, but you are still doing that intelligence analysis piece.
Right. One of the things I talk about in the chapter three of the book that I wrote was how broad intelligence really is, and how, you know, that it's really embedded into every part of our society. And I even bring up sports teams. You know, every football team does, you know, looks at, you know, training films, or looks at their injured roster, or looks at past performance of the team they're going to go up against to try to pattern them and predict how they're going to play. They're doing the exact same functions of collecting, processing, and analysis, and coming up with an answer that somebody in the military is using. They just don't call it that. So the same function is found, you know, the analytical process and the intel process is fundamental. It's in every walk of life. We just got to call it something different, whether it's called corporate security or, you know, competitive analysis or whatever.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know your talks are always very informative, and we really enjoy having you. You've done a lot of stuff for us. I think we've got a lot of people typing in the chat. Yes, they're all very appreciative, so I like to see that. The next session that we have coming up for our Intel Hub is going to occur on September 10th at 10 a.m., where we have Daniela Bacash-Torres that will be presenting on capitalizing on competition. So I will be sending out additional information on that. If you guys have any questions or follow-up for Eric, you see his email address there in the room, and I'm also happy to forward questions to him as well. And as I mentioned earlier, you can find the recording for this on our website. And again, thank you for joining us this morning, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Great, thank you.
All right, thanks everyone. Thanks, Eric. Thanks again, Eric.
Oh, no problem.